edge, that little difference that makes all the difference of the world. In other words, what is the difference? The little difference is your attitude, and the big difference is whether it's positive or negative. Why do we always talk about expectation? Because expectation is directly proportional to motivation. Why? Well, because you won't get what you want in life many times, but you will get what you expect. And that's because of the power of the self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, I've been studying the self-fulfilling prophecy for nearly 30 years. I've been studying it in prisoners of war, in astronauts, Olympic athletes, executives, parents, and children. You'll get what you expect more than what you want. Expectation equals motivation. Why? Because you're only motivated to do that which you expect to be able to achieve. So don't tell your children, just do your best. They have no idea what it is. Expect something specifically from your children, and then have them try to do that specific thing, which then they can expect to improve on. But if you tell them to do their best, they would have no idea of what that was, because none of us knows how good we are or what our limits or limitations are. Limits are physical, and limitations are psychological. And that's why it's so important to understand the self-fulfilling prophecy. The self-fulfilling prophecy is a concept or idea that is neither necessarily true nor false, but it becomes true when you believe it and internalize it. It becomes self-fulfilling. In other words, I knew that would happen with my luck. Oh, here we go again. Or, I expected to win. You know, many, many years ago, as I watched in my earliest days of psychology, this incredible young Olympic swimmer, and you may hear of her, you may remember her, or you may not, but she has an interesting name. Her name is Shane Gould. And Shane Gould was 14, and she was at Sunnyvale, California, swimming against the best in the world at that time, and I heard what she said to the media. "How do you think you'll do, honey?" She said, "I have a feeling there'll be a world's record today." "Oh, a little cocky Aussie, aren't you?" "No, I didn't say who'd said it. I just have a feeling there'll be a world's record today." She set the world's record in the 100-meter freestyle, the 200-meter freestyle the next day. "How do you think you'll do against Debbie Meyer, Dawn Fraser, best in the world, Shane?" "Well, I had a little left at the end of the 100, and I think I'll do pretty well. I've really been training hard." She set the world's record in the 200-meter freestyle. The next race, the next day, was the 400-meter freestyle. "How do you think you'll do?" She said, "Well, I get stronger every race. And besides, my parents said they'd take me to Disneyland when I win, and we're leaving day after tomorrow." Is this just the expectation of an overconfident young woman? I think not. I think the fact that she was preparation plus expectation equals the motivation to get the realization. In other words, you prepare, you expect the best, you train, and then you realize. And that's why it's so important to understand the power of the human mind, and why it's so important to embrace optimism, qualified optimism, meaning I'm optimistic because I'm getting more knowledge, more training, more skills, so that then I can expect to achieve my goals. I call it the blue eyes versus brown eyes story. You may remember years ago in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, or in Iowa, I don't know whether it was Des Moines or Cedar Rapids, a grammar school teacher, I believe in kindergarten, decided to do an experiment with her class. And you may remember she hung a sign around the necks of children. And of course, there were a few in the class who had blue eyes, and there were many that had dark eyes or brown eyes, and she decided to do an experiment. She said, "Blue eyes are bright and brown eyes are slow." Now, she wasn't being prejudiced against any ethnic group, because so few people have blue eyes anyway when they get older. Blue eyes are bright and brown eyes are not as bright. Down came the achievement of the brown eyes. upshot the achievement and expectation of the blue eyes until after a couple of months, she came in and said she'd made a terrible mistake. All children and babies are born with weak blue eyes. And as they get older and stronger, their eyes get darker. Down plummeted the performance of the blue eyes, and up went the performance of the brown eyes. I look at faith as optimism and voodoo as pessimism. And the interesting thing about voodoo is it's an ancient belief about your ancestors that if you cast a certain spell, that that spell will surely come true as a self-fulfilling prophecy. You may remember one of the great psychologists, Benson, Herbert Benson of Harvard. He wrote some great books on the optimism of the mind and the mind-body effect, that what the mind harbors, the body manifests in some way. And he showed about an experiment that was done in New Guinea. And you may remember, and if you don't remember, this will certainly ring a bell with you. In certain tribal areas where voodoo is practiced, the witch doctor has all the power. In a family, it could be the father or mother. In a company, it could be the general manager or president or whoever is in charge. So remember, when you're practicing voodoo, you have to be very careful because the natives or team might really believe you in a negative prophecy. I remember in one company when the general manager came in to a circuit board company and said, unless we improve productivity 17%, we're going to close the plant. Close the plant was the dominant thought. Unless we do this, this is going to happen. And they thought to themselves, why wait? Let's quit now. So instead of trying to get the 70% improvement, they made sure that the plant was closed because a form of voodoo was being given. Well, the same thing happened in the tribe in New Guinea. The witch doctor has the power. The team knows he has the power. The team knows that he knows more than they do about the outcome. He's the prognosticator. And so he plays a game which we used to play as children. We used to play a game called spin the bottle. And you would take a bottle and spin it. When it landed on you, you were it. When it landed on somebody else, a girl, and it was me, I got to kiss her. It was called spin the bottle. Not in this tribe. In the tribe in New Guinea, they played spin the bone. And they took a parched chicken bone with a point at one end, and the witch doctor learned how to spin it so that he could make it spin just enough rotations. That's what witch doctors do. They learn from the previous witch doctor how it's done. You spin the bone so that it lands on the person you want to get rid of. And in that tribe, when you're boned and the spin the bone hits you, you're out. Your heart goes into ventricular fibrillation. You die of a massive fear-induced cardiac arrest because voodoo is belief going in the opposite direction. Faith is in things unknown and yet believed. Voodoo is in negative things unknown yet believed. I'll always remember in the British Medical Journal the story of the little girl who went to the fortune teller with her mother. And for some reason, the fortune teller decided to say that the girl had a short lifeline and that she thought that she had to be careful that she might die at an early age. And she even gave the year how old the young girl would be when she might die. Incredibly, the girl, when she became a woman, age 37, remembered what the fortune teller had predicted, went in for minor surgery and said to her sister, I have a feeling I won't come out of this operation. And they could give no reason for it. The test didn't show any conclusive evidence, except that when the mind talks, the body listens, and sometimes it can be a very traumatic experience. Norman Cousins, he had a debilitating illness, one that was normally fatal. He had gotten it and contracted it on a trip. And he began to waste away and become very ill. And the doctors said they didn't know what they could do about it. He studied his illness. He studied everything about it. And he found the strangest thing. As he was bedridden, when he would watch Three Stooges, the Marx Brothers, Candid Camera, and he would laugh, the laughter gave him more energy and made him feel better. And he began to realize what happens when you laugh, when you're optimistic, when you're positive. You release those incredible morphine-like substances that are painkillers and energy builders, the endorphins. Endorphin means morphine within. And morphine within comes in optimists who don't need a shot, a pill, a shopping spree, some kind of escape to get them high. They get high on their expectations. And as Norman Cousins laughed, he laughed his way and optimist himself. In other words, the biology of optimism, the biology of faith, actually helped him cure his disease, which was almost impossible. It was written up in all the journals. He became a professor at UCLA and went on to become a great lecturer on the idea of the anatomy of an illness as perceived by the patient. Now, I believe in the finest medical care of all, and I also believe that the winner's edge is having that expectation of optimism on top. You're driven by two main motivations: desire, I want to, I can, or fear, I have to, I can't. Which is your primary motivation? Desire is propulsion, and fear is compulsion. Desire is ignition, and fear is inhibition. Do you want to be driven by a hammer or stopped by a red light? Or do you want to be driven by the propulsion of a rocket or given the green light to go ahead? Winners dwell on the reward of success, and losers dwell on the penalties of failure. You think of the reward, you move toward it. You think of the penalty, and you move toward it. And there are so many actual documented cases that this isn't just New Age thinking. This goes back to the Old Testament, the New Testament, and everything that science knows. One of the great stories that I checked out that is true was made into a motion picture, and it is called The Train. You may remember it was way back, I think, in the 1980s. It could have been before that. I think it was the 1980s. In Omaha, Nebraska, it was a spring day, and you may remember the boxcar of the train was inside the yard. And the boxcar was a refrigerator boxcar, and the man that was supposed to go and fix it was named Nick Sitzman, and he was fairly pessimistic. He was the usual griper, maybe the kind of guy that says, you know, I don't know what we're going to do about the government. I think we got a lot of problems. I don't think I'll be able to retire. I'm feeling a little ill. And he was a guy that was always kind of a victim of the system. And he said to them, you know, it's supposed to be a party we're having today, and they've asked me to go in and fix that refrigerator car. What do I know about refrigerator cars? I don't know how to fix them. Why me? Why does it always have to be me? He walks over to the refrigerator car. Now remember, it's inside the lot on a spring day, and it's inoperative. And they want him to see what's wrong with it to fix it. He climbs inside, and two men walking by close it and lock it, not seeing him inside, and go to the party. As they go to the party, he yells. But the sound of the train whistle and the sound of the noise from the train yard blocks out his yells. And he yelled, and he yelled, and he yelled. And for the next 2 hours, he began to consider his situation. I got to get out of here. How am I going to get out of here? I'm locked in here. It's beginning to get cold in here. I'm in a refrigerator boxcar. It's getting cold. I'm running out of air. I don't think I can make it. Getting weak now. Getting cold. And he scribbled on a cardboard box, freezing in refrigerator car, I love you. Goodbye. About the next morning, I guess maybe it was early in the morning, they found that he was in there because he didn't come home at night. They opened the refrigerator car and he was dead. And they did an autopsy and they wouldn't know the results until then. But before then, they said, gee, it was a spring day. The temperature never got below 66. There was plenty of ventilation. And he certainly wouldn't have died of lack of water or food. He literally thought that he was freezing to death. And his mind brought his temperature down. And he froze to death in his mind rather than from the external environment. I've been watching tight wire walkers and they're amazing. They wear slippers with an open toe and they set their foot up the wire and then the next foot behind it up the wire, next foot, and they're always looking at where they're going. You watch their obsession, it's on the desired result or the expectation. But what if you and I were their coach? And what if we said, windy day, no net? Oh, then they begin to think of what would happen, and the mind always moves in the direction of the expectation of the dominant thought. That's why we say that winners dwell on the reward of success, and losers always dwell on the penalty of failure. And I know in my own case, it's a lot like my golf handicap. My golf handicap will tell me exactly what I should do. For example, one day when it was beautiful, I wasn't paying attention to my handicap, which was 18. You add 18 to 72, and what do you get? You get 90. You get 90 almost every time you play. But why? Because it's my handicap. It's my self-image. It's my left arm or my right arm. And one day I shot a 36 on the front nine, and somebody said, do you know what you did? I said, no, I wasn't paying any attention. They said, you shot even par, pal. That's not like you. I said, I guess not. And my RU Me Too, my little robot reticular activating system that we talked about in an earlier segment, made me shoot a 57 on the back nine. It gave me a water-seeking ball and a trap-seeking ball. I adjusted to my handicap because I was uncomfortable because my expectation was for 90 instead of even par. And this comes to one of my favorite people in the world, that marvelous super optimist on the senior tour who is one of the all-time leading money winners in golf, Lee Trevino. He said, you know, I used to be a poor Hispanic. Now I'm a rich Spaniard. He said, you know, I always win the Canadian Open. It's my tournament. He got hit by lightning. He said, well, straighten me up. Thanks, Lord. And he's just the kind of guy that always wins golf tournaments. Well, we were playing at the Andy Williams San Diego Isuzu Shearson Lehman American Express Buick Open. In the days that I played, you needed a lot of sponsors to get a big purse. And there we were out in the Pro-Am. And Lee Trevino plays in the Pro-Am, and he's really funny. He said, you know, I'll play you guys for $100 a hole and give each of you double your handicap. I said, sold, great. We can do that. Double our handicap means that I doesn't matter what I shoot, I'll probably win. And he said, on top of that, I'll play you with an empty Dr. Pepper bottle as my only club. I said, you got to be. What do you mean, Dr. Pepper bottle? How do you do that? He said, I put a rope in it. And then I swing it through, and then I use it as a pool cue, and I'll play you with a pop bottle, and you use your full bag, Dennis. You have a natural slice. I've been watching you on the driving range, and you swing inside and out with an open stance. I said, don't remind me of what I'm not and what I don't want to be and where I'm coming from. On the first tee in front of all those people, I got down over the ball, and he made a classic expectation statement. He said, do you breathe in or out on your backswing? I said, what? He said, do you go or hold your breath on your backswing? I said, I don't know. I never think about that. He said, think about it right now as you go up. As I thought about whether I did this or that, I broke my concentration and hit the ball from the blue to the red tees, and we were on our way. He talked about the tree over there, which I went to find out with my ball. He talked about the sand and a nice day for the beach. I went there to explore. Everything that he said was setting me up for the reverse of an idea. And finally, after six holes, owing him $600, I'd had enough. I got down over the ball, got my simulation, got my winner's edge, got concentration out, looked down the fairway and said, I'm not cotton candy, I'm an astronaut trainer. And then he gave me my final bit of expectation. He said, I notice you're using an old ball. I said, I use an old ball in case I go into water. It's insurance. And I hit my Smiley Titleist into the water and we all laughed. Because it's really hard to concentrate on the reverse of an idea. You see, the winner's edge and the winning edge is expecting the best, preparation, expectation, motivation, simulation, realization. You will not get what you want in life many times, but in the long run, you will get what you expect. Expect the best, plan for the worst, and accept what you get, but always remember the self-fulfilling prophecy. It's an idea that may not yet be true, may not be false, but becomes true when you believe it and internalize it and concentrate and focus on it. Expectation rules the world, and the operative word is optimism.